Okay, so as I was saying before I started to record, we're going to go over the last of our authors in the set list. In this case, it's from Unit 24, Stephen Crane, and I think Stephen Crane is a really interesting author. And the problem is that he still, I'm hopefully saying still, because I think he will end up meriting it, he still doesn't have the reputation that he should probably deserve, for probably the same reasons that Edgar Allan Poe didn't have a good reputation at the beginning of his literary analysis of his work once he had passed away. Similar to Edgar Allan Poe, Stephen Crane left the world a bit like a rock star. He's part of that legendary list of people that died at age 28, lives fast, dies young, and leaves a beautiful corpse behind. If we have to connect him to someone, we can connect him very easily to Edgar Allan Poe. If we have to connect him to another type of writer, we can connect him very easily to Benjamin Franklin, because he's our prototype of a journalist. But this is more the prototype of a freelance journalist. Stephen Crane wasn't a publisher or someone very powerful, as Benjamin Franklin was, not very wealthy. He was a reporter, one of those beat reporters, the ones that are, in Spanish, they say, al cabo de la calle, one of those reporters that was always interested in being where the story was. And the end of the 19th century is a period that is full of war, it's full of turmoil. And the story that we're going to read today, in boats, is idiosyncratic of that type of dangerous life that he lived, where his passion led him to facing situations that were not the safest situations possible. And here he meets death at a very close distance. He faces death at a very close distance and talks about his encounter with nature in a brutal, at the same time in a detached way. The end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, is a crossroads of many literary movements. Therefore, Stephen Crane is going to be very difficult to apply him a specific tag, because you could add more than one tag. We know that we've been talking about this last block of authors as a realist. And it is true, there is a lot of realism in the way he conveys a story, but there's also naturalism, this literary movement, or artistic movement, rather, that grants the amount of importance to humanity that humans have in the natural cycle of life. Man is very delicate and weak in the hands of the overpowering nature. So it's nature taken from the point of view, but it really isn't here for men. It's the opposite. Men are here to enjoy nature. And nature is the enveloping force around us. He also has traits of two movements that are probably more famous, especially the second one, or other artistic movements rather than literature, both symbolism, where we find a great deal of literature, especially in France, and impressionism. From that point of view, we can say that his works have those traits, all of those movements. Impressionism, if you remember the impressionist, impressionist painters, it was a matter of creating state of consciousness rather than focusing on the minute detail. It's creating the this picture with rapid brush strokes that don't aim at position, they aim at emotion. So in that same way, his story is not geared at giving us all the details, but it's giving us some brush strokes that are relevant to our own analysis of the story. Okay, so what Stephen Crane is painting for us is a picture in an impressionistic manner in order for us to have that point of view. For example, the quote that we have here, the horizon narrowed and widened and dipped and rose, and in all times its edge was jagged with waves that seamed up in points like rocks. He's talking about a dinghy, a boat that is at mercy of this violent sea. This happened. The events that are told in Open Boat come from his experience when he capsized with a boat. I think it's called the USS Commodore, and with a group of people from the boat. He was on a dinghy on the rescue boat in between Florida and Cuba. He was traveling to Cuba in order to cover the conflict between the local population and the Spanish dwindling empire. And he had that incident during his trip there. And Open Boat is about that situation aboard that dinghy that he decides to call an open boat because it has no way of covering him. And that happened, I think it was on January the 2nd of, I would say it's 1896. I'll get the year right afterwards. And he published it as a newspaper story 5 days later. After a near-death experience, he still had that journalist inside of him to tell the story and to publish it, publish the incident in the first person. And in the case of Open Boat, it's a fictional account that is based on the incident, but it doesn't have to resemble 100% the accuracy. So it's taking the same work that he already produced for a newspaper and transforming it for a different work of art. Stephen Crane is considered a major storyteller of American literature. He's also considered a minor poet. That means that his relevance is significant, but he's more celebrated as a writer than as a poet. And in the case of a Professor Tsuged and the contents that she decided to collect for the book, she focused only on extracts from Open Boat. I have to say that it's not a very long extract in this case that's going to help us be able to read it in time and be able to cover all the material. And also his contribution as a poet, how Open Boat, besides Open Boat, how he has a fairly relevant amount of poetry penned. And The Poem War is Kind is a poem that is especially significant. I've changed the presentation for this year because I never collected War is Kind in a slide, and I decided that it would be a good idea because it's such a good poem. It's very concise, and it reminds us to those war poems that have become so popular that you'll probably read in English literature that you've already read. The type of by Owen and Flanders Field. I don't know if you remember those war poems of World War I. Maybe you haven't encountered them yet. Remember this when we talk about this. Stephen Crane is anticipating that kind of poems, a poem where war is not seen as something heroic. So it's satirical and anti-bellic. It's an anti-bellic anti-war satirical piece. We're going to try to illustrate the personality of Crane as someone that was bohemian, rebellious. He rebelled against his upbringing. He rebelled against the education that he received, against the norm, the social norm of the time, and he crossed many red lines from the social point of view, and that garnered him a reputation that was by no means a good reputation. He had a very bad reputation right after passing away, and that had a very significant toll on the appreciation for his literary work. I think that if we have to put an example to that, I know it has absolutely nothing to do because afterwards, Crane's situation has been reevaluated in the light of a very bad first biography, in the same way as Edgar Allan Poe. But I can't help finding it curious that people that have loved, for example, the work of Woody Allen their entire life, right now there is this drive of being an absolute renegade of everything that Woody Allen has ever touched. I don't know if you've heard that he's had problems to shoot a new film. Nobody wants to produce him. They've canceled a series that Amazon had hired for him. He's in the middle of huge scandals. Probably from the point of view of guiltiness, he had it coming. But I just want you to realize that dichotomy that we humans have. We don't feel the same appreciation for writers that we are not able to admire. So if the biography is very, very negative, it anchors down the appreciation of the work. And sometimes that appreciation is an evaluation of the time and afterwards is lifted. But in our times, we feel, I think that we're in a reverse situation where creators that we admired very much are being reevaluated in the light of a new way of seeing the world. Stanley Kubrick, Woody Allen, they're following the reverse paths than maybe Edgar Allan Poe and Stephen Crane traversed. In both cases, you can find a lot of parallelisms. This dying young at a crazy young age, being extremely productive from the literary point of view, and leaving a few tall tales or extravagant facts about their biography. I mean, if Edgar Allan Poe lived nowadays, nobody would ever read him. He was married to his 13-year-old cousin. I mean, it doesn't get more scandalous than that. Well, it might get more scandalous than that, because Stephen Crane raised more than eyebrows and created a huge uproar and a scandal by living with his common-law wife. That means that he was not married by the church. Something that sounded terrible in late 19th century United States. I think, just imagine how your parents or grandparents would be seen by their neighbors or friends if they had decided to not marry through the church and marry outside of church. If we go further back than the 60s, in Spain, it's simply not conceivable. It's not a situation that anybody can conceive of. Not only was his marriage to Cora Taylor scandalous, the profession of Cora Taylor was even more scandalous. She was an ex-owner of a brothel, a whorehouse in Florida. So it was not the most decent of lives. And of course, that marked very much the reputation that he had during this year. So we're going to see that as a poet and a fiction worker, he's hugely talented. He marks a period of that is considered social realism, where you have to think about this intersection with those three very dominant movements of the time: impressionism, symbolism, and naturalism. And at the same time, he's also considered a precursor of existentialism or expressionism. So there's six movements involved in his biography. That means that the small glimpse that we're going to see of Stephen Crane in the course book is just something very small. I mean, one of those hidden jewels that I hope that you take the opportunity this year to discover, and maybe at another point in your life where you have more free time and you sleep 8 hours a day, for example, you can devote some attention in your reading list to Stephen Crane, to Kay Chapin, to all these authors that many of you might be discovering for the first time. I hope that's the case. The Red Badge of Courage is the work where probably most of his current reputation lies. It's considered a masterpiece, and it gained the author international fame because of its innovation. He's a social realist that feeds on different literary styles and is able to apply them both in long fiction and in short fiction. Open Boat is considered also a masterpiece of short stories, and for example, it's been hugely praised by authors that are not suspicious of not knowing about literature, such as Joseph Conrad or H.G. Wells. They consider it probably the best short story of the time. And for a very long time, Open Boat has been considered one of the best short stories in American literature. So it's that big. It's a very significant work, and I wanted you to be able to understand that it has that height. And here comes his awkward biography, because it seems that all his life decisions go in an opposite direction of what his parents wanted for him. The son of a minister, a 14th son of a revivalist Methodist minister, and a super pious mother. His mother wrote in a biblical journal about religion. Of course, she couldn't imagine that the most impious of the subjects she would come across in her life would be one of her own children, one of her kin. He very soon rebelled against the ideas that they were trying to impose on him from school. And even though he was very good at literature and at history, he especially excelled, according to his biography, at sports and gambling at a very young age. So that just goes to show that he, from a conservative or a narrow-minded point of view, he was always a lost case. He dropped out of Syracuse University to become a writer, and his writing ambitions led him to New York, where he would turn into a freelance journalist. Some other elements, I think I've taken some notes. Yeah, the idea that we get nowadays when we read him is that he's basically a nonconformist, and that he has a halo of mystery. There is something mysterious about the way he writes. There is this legendary bohemian lifestyle that is very appealing, but at the same time, you don't know exactly how precise it is. Even though his goal in life was to try to sound objective, which is not the same as being objective, it's just sounding objective, was his main concern. The elusiveness that we talked about in terms of the style that he had writing is present in most of the treatment of everything except probably the treatment of nature. He tends to treat nature with a huge array of adjectives and with a sense of personification of natural elements. Let me go back for a second and show you the quote, which might gain a bit more height nowadays. I mean, at this moment, the horizon narrowed and widened and dipped and rose, and at all times its edge was jagged with waves that seamed up in points like rock. There seems to be like a conscience in the tide that is trying to fight against something or attack something. We're going to get those very rich descriptions. They're full of adjectives and are geared at creating a very rich characterization of nature. As is the case of most successful writers, he did terribly from the financial point of view, but his life was full of excitement and adventure. He was a prolific journalist, a hugely prolific writer. He only wrote for 8 years. Despite that, his complete works span 12 volumes, which is a huge amount of work. Okay, so this is only the analysis, the literary analysis of some of his short stories. So this is the analysis. So the short stories are in a different volume. There is a collection, a compiled collection, I think it's from the early 20th century, of the 12 volumes of his work, and that has been like the representation of his literary contribution. Due to the fact that he was depicted in a not very faithful manner, and due to his life being so awkward and sometimes very close to the absurd, his personal exploits became legendary, and his bohemian lifestyle and bravery in the battlefield as a war correspondent garnered him a great amount of fame. I think that when we think about a writer like this, it's probably when it's similar to from the point of view of how daring he was and how willing he was to be in the first line of action. It might remind us to the early, the young years of Revolución Española, and he would be in every single war zone. If there were bombs falling somewhere in the world, he was there with a helmet, reporting from the front row of the action. And I guess must make good material for writers, because has also fed on that experience to be able to produce a lot of his work. Open Boat is a retelling of an incident that he experienced firsthand and that he previously wrote about in a journalistic piece after capsizing on a trip from Florida to Cuba. From the point of view of work, he worked, I think that's probably the best adjective that you can find to designate his activity, feverish. He produced a feverish amount of work that spans, as I said, 12 volumes, two complete volumes of poetry. The second one is what we talked about, the one that has the title of the poem that I've included in another slide, War is Kind. 5 novels and 300 short stories. Okay, that's a huge amount. His initial biographers portrayed a biased interpretation of his life that harmed his literary reputation. He was in favor of writing fiction about true events, which is something that is particularly interesting, but afterwards with, for example, magical realism, which is a South American, mainly a South American movement, we saw that turned into a trait. So from that point of view, when you read his portrayals, you might get a reminiscence to, without that magical component inside, to the areas of interest of, for example, Gabriel García Márquez, writing about things that really happened, but twisting them in such a way that makes it different. I think that from the point of view of a journalist that transitions from journalism to literature, or that goes back and forth between literature and journalism, this navigating between reality and fiction is something that tends to merge both. There is a point where it seems to be a valid option to mix fact and fiction. How much is factual in Open Boat and how much is fictional? Very hard to tell, because you have to trust the word of the journalist. If you believe him when he wrote his journalistic accounts, That's okay, but maybe that's not factual either. So since he has that capacity of not being 100% factual, we have that situation where we're unable to distinguish where to draw the line. And that's something that is in favor of, that is favored by realism, because the realism tries to portray situations in a trustworthy manner. And from that point of view, being faithful to a realistic depiction of the world is something that makes mixing fact and fiction easier to carry out. Sometimes he was a character inside his writings, because he fictionalized situations that he lived. In Open Boat, he is one of the characters, but you can see that there is no significant difference between him and other characters in the story. The characters in the story serve the purpose of telling the story, but it's not, I'm going to tell my story and you're going to see it from my point of view. You're going to see a story where he is one of the participants. Okay, and that's different from the point of view of other narrative personas, where the writer is at the same time part of the action, but doesn't give his character the narrative persona, and has like an external narrative persona leading the voice of the narration. His eclectic style is sometimes difficult to grasp. It's elusive. Especially, I gave you six literary movements, six artistic movements. Very difficult to pinpoint style, because he flows in a very natural fashion from one style to another, and he's like a hybrid mix of many different movements. As I said before, many see alignment with 19th century movements. Some see him anticipating 20th century movements, and at the same time, we have defined him as a realist, as a social realist. So those would be six different movements inside or referring to the same writer. The Red Badge of Courage is innovative from the stylistic point of view, and is also fresh from the point of view of psychological death. And some people describe it as a war novel, but battle is just an excuse to tell a story about the main character's point of view, reactions, and responses to this element of war. You can obviously tell that Stephen Crane felt a paradoxical attraction towards war, that he felt that he had the obligation to be in front line and report, but at the same time, he didn't seem to agree very much with the tenets of war. So it's kind of weird to have an anti-bellic person working as a war correspondent voluntarily. So it seems a contradictory situation. His work was praised, we'll read about that in a few minutes, by authors such as Joseph Conrad or H.G. Wells. In The Open Boat, there is a clear naturalistic and realistic flavor to the story. Okay, in this short story in particular, we won't get all of the variety of Stephen Crane that we can get if we, for example, read the Red Badge of Courage or other stories. Critics tend to agree that Crane has an impressionistic tint to all of his stories. And there is a significant way of treating color, day and night. A few years ago, when we were talking about this story, I remember that a student asked about a picture or a painting of the time, and trying to compare a work of art from the point of view of painting and a work of art from the literary point of view. And afterwards, in the master's degree, it's one of the typical things to find, that interpretation of a different artistic work with a literary work. I think that the works of Stephen Crane are very appropriate for these type of reinterpretations in the light. Let me see how people painted in the mid-19th century. Let me see how they painted around the time of Stephen Crane. Let me see how they painted in the middle of the 20th century. What evolution do I notice? What's characteristic of the way that nature is expressed? Well, in the same way that nature is expressed in a painting, we can extract some of those conclusions and apply them to literature. And that's something that, as scholars, if you have an interest in pursuing a master's degree, it's a very interesting exercise to explore and to improve your skills. I talked about before how important the sea is in this narrative. It's characterized in an extremely rich way using many adjectives. It's treated as just another character of the story. The open boat is notable for its use of imagery, irony, symbolism, and some themes, some very relevant themes, such as survival, solidarity, and this conflict, this unequal conflict between man and nature. And many artistic movements have tended to put man at the center of the universe and explain that nature is at the service of men. But I think that Stephen Crane rebalances the situation to explain how minute mankind is in the light of the powerful and infinite nature. I think that it's very much in the line of what we've been reading from Emerson, and how there was an appreciation, a rediscovered appreciation for nature. But for example, Walt Whitman, it used nature as a global arc of things, and men as just participants of this global everything. Probably Stephen Crane's perspective is a more negative one in this relationship between man and nature, indicating that man is just minute and insignificant in the global scheme of things for nature. And interesting motifs and symbols can be drowning, the waves, the boat, or, spoiler alert, the Euler's death. I've just ruined the entire short story for you guys. Very sorry about that. Just in case you don't have enough time to read it. So, without further ado, we're going to read the story. The story is on page 476. And before I read the story, I'm going to read from A Reader's Guide to the Short Stories of Stephen Crane by a scholar called Michael W. Schaffer. I think they've taken this book out three times. I've probably been the one that's taken it four times, and I've probably taken it out three of those four times. I'm pretty convinced that the fourth time is Professor Pugel. The previous time was from 1999, so I would guess that's probably true. It definitely wasn't me. I love that time. So here I'm going to read the beginning of several sections. It has one chapter for every short story. On page 296, it talks about open time. Described in alphabetical order. And it talks about, it gives us a lot of in between the line information, and I think that you'll find it relevant. I would say that I'm almost convinced that it's going to be in the bibliography of the textbook, because it's a perfect book to extract information from to write a textbook. The story was first published in America in June 1897 in a magazine called Scribner's. Unlike most of Crane's fiction, he did not run in an English magazine. As well. Since Crane was a journalist with a reputation, he was able to sell his pieces not only for American magazines, but for English magazines. So he duplicated his earnings, and Being a journalist favored being a writer, being a writer favored being a journalist. So it was a virtuous circle, which is a refreshing change in a course full of vicious circles. Get poorer, write less, get poorer, write less. In this case, it was a virtuous circle of having a reputation during his lifetime, but living too fast, dying too young in the case of Crane. So this one in particular was only published in America. And it appeared in a volume. I think that he had an appreciation, a personal appreciation for this work, because it appeared as the opening title for a book called The Open Boat and Other Tales of Adventure. It has been collected in other collections of stories, including the work of Stephen Crane in 12 volumes from 1925. I said from the early 20th century. I had that memory right. The situation of how he capsizes naufragar. On December the 31st, 1896, Crane sailed out of Jacksonville, Florida, aboard the steamer Commodore. It was bound for Cuba, the site of a revolt against Spanish rule that Crane intended to cover as a correspondent for the Bachelor newspaper syndicate. So as you can see, things had changed very much since the times of Benjamin Franklin, and the journalists were already syndicated, and that allowed freelance journalists to be able to sell one story to several newspapers and multiply the amount of money. The journalistic syndicates are the pioneer organizations to news agencies. Okay, syndication still is very strong in America. However, the Commodore sank off the Florida coast in the early morning of January the 2nd, 1897, and Crane and three members of the crew spent the next 30 hours in a dinghy before coming ashore, exhausted, near Daytona Beach. The problem why they were exhausted, and you'll realize afterwards, is they had to row to not be sent out into open water and die for sure. So they had to row against the currents and try to get as close as possible and risk swimming to the shore. So that's what this situation is about. The fight of man against nature. If you want to think of an overarching dominant theme, it's going to be that. The struggle of man against nature, in this case against the sea that is ferocious. And I think that we all have this idyllic view or this idyllic idea of Florida and Cuba, and we're not expecting people to die in terrible conditions. But, I mean, in Spain we have another coast situation where hundreds of people, unfortunately, wind up drowned on their way to the coast of Andalusia. So I think it's very easy to find that relation and how dangerous the sea can be. And just think of the difference between the Mediterranean Sea and the Atlantic Ocean. It's a completely different story. By January the 6th, back in Jacksonville, he had written a newspaper report for the sinking, which ran as Stephen Crane's own story in the New York Press for January 7th. And over the next month, so there was 1 month period of time, he composed The Open Boat, taken from his experience in the dinghy. I don't know if I want to read any more from that period, from that part. There was another part that I wanted to refer to, because I was rereading it this morning, and I thought it would be interesting to talk about that. Yeah, no, two sections. The relationship of Crane with other works, basically the most obvious relationship is something very weird. He writes different versions of the same story. He lives a story, he writes a journalistic piece, and then he writes a fictional piece. Like iterations of the same events, overlaying one on top of the other. And he doesn't seem to find a contradictory situation in writing immediately a fictional story about a real story that he's happened to report in first person, not because he was a counter. I think it's an unusual case. From the point of view of critical acclaim, Open Boat is one of the most frequently discussed works in Crane's canon, and indeed in the entire canon of the American short story. It has also been one of the most highly praised from the time of its initial appearance to the present. Joseph Conrad offered the first favorable judgment, writing Crane shortly after the story was published, that he found it immensely interesting. And he says to Crane, "You shock, and the next moment you give the perfect artistic satisfaction. The illusions of life come out of your hands without a flaw. It is not life which nobody wants. It is art." In the same way, H.G. Wells, a few years later, pronounced Open Boat to be Crane's best story because it is a combination of the stark power of the author's earlier work and a sense of restraint. At the same time, he's unleashing his talent, but he's contained. And H.G. Wells talks about Crane's handling of color. And I think that's really interesting because it's something that is probably not specifically expressed in the... I don't see that I skipped the poem. I seem to not have included in the PDF file. I have it in the PowerPoint presentation. I'll read it now for you. Crane's Treatment of Color by H.G. Wells. He says, Crane's work is as full and strong as ever, fuller and stronger indeed. The chromatic splashes that at times deafen and confuse in the Red Badge are images that enlighten and are controlled in this work. So he sees, in the case of H.G. Wells, he sees an evolution of the writer between other works and this one. So this type of positive assessment is contradictory with the amount of bad rap that he received because of his biography. Before I read from The Open Boat, let me quickly go back a few pages to page 471. It talks about Crane's, in the last paragraph, it talks about Crane's first book of poetry. It says that it's called The Black Writers. It's a collection of 68 short poems in free verse. As you can see, very much in the line, for example, of Walt Whitman. And his second collection of poetry is called War is Kind, 1899. And even though I don't have it there, I think I can bring it up because I took it this morning from the Poetry Foundation, so it shouldn't be very difficult to find. Okay, well, War is Kind, as the book says in the last part of page 471, is bitter, satirical, and anti-war. And all of those elements contradict Stephen Crane's personal biography because he was voluntarily entangled in that situation. It has three stanzas. It's very simple, as you can see it. You have it on the screen. If anybody's watching the recording, just Google War is Kind. You'll find the same poem in three stanzas, and I'm going to read it now. There is a part that is dedicated to a maiden, a part that is dedicated to a child, and a part that is dedicated to a mother. So there's probably the three people that have all the loss in a war, in the name of a country, in the name of a nation, in the name of ideals, in the name of liberty, in the name of justice, freedom, whatever the situation. At the end of the day, who suffers is the orphan child, the fiancé that will never get married, the mother that loses a son, the wife that is suddenly widowed. Those are the true victims of a war. The collateral damage that nobody thinks about and that Stephen Crane concentrates on in this work. Let me read it for you because I think it's really short and it's really powerful. Do not weep, maiden, for war is kind. So it's very ironic from the very first line. Because your lover threw wild hands towards the sky, and the affrighted steed ran on alone. Do not weep, war is kind. As you can see, it's repetitive. Every single stanza, it ends with the same two lines. Hoarse booming drums of the regiment, little souls who thirst for fight. These men were born to drill and die. The unexplained glory flies above them. Great is the battle god, great in his kingdom. A field where a thousand corpses lie. Do not weep, babe, for war is kind. This is for the child. Because your father tumbled in the yellow trenches. Yellow was a color of napalm that was already a very important poison and a source of and a huge source of death in the First World War and not only napalm but other chemicals that were extensively used at the beginning of the 20th century as they were discovered their power in military conflicts. That's why it's referring to the yellow trenches. Again, inscribe in your mind Owen Wilson and the war poets. When you read this, you're going to be reminiscent of Stephen Crane. Do not weep, babe, for war is kind, because your father tumbled in the yellow trenches, raged at his breast, gulped and died. That means he died suffocated. He wasn't able to breathe. Do not weep, war is kind. It's absolutely the opposite what he's describing, but he uses that irony. Swift, blazing, flag of the regiment, eagle with crest of red and gold, like the colors of regal, of a proud flag, those emblems. These men were born to drill and die. Point for them the virtue of slaughter. Make plain to them the excellence of killing and a field where a thousand corpses lie. Mother, who hearts hung humble as a button on the bright, splendid shroud of your son. Do not weep, war is kind. Okay, shroud is the garment that we people wear when they die. Sudario, is that how you call it in Spanish? I'm not very sure. I think so. I'm not very sure right now. Okay, well, I'm sorry that isn't in the presentation. I'll upload it afterward because I think it's one of those short poems that it's really significant to know about them and enjoy and add to your collection of poetic knowledge. Page 476, Open Boat. The Open Boat is one of the most famous of American short stories. It has also been one of the most highly praised by literary critics. From the time of its appearance to the present, it was initially published in the June 1897 issue of the Scribner's Magazine and reprinted the following year in a volume of short fiction dedicated by Crane to the three men who were with him in the dinghy after the sinking of the Commodore. Since then, it has been frequently anthologized and is currently included in American literature courses. Because it is a rather long short story, we will only read its first and last sections. Okay? I don't remember if we play the audio, if people are going to be able to hear it. Not, because that didn't work the other day. I'm just going to read it. From The Open Boat. The Open Boat, a tale intended to be after the fact, being the experience of four men from the sunk steamer Commodore. None of them knew the color of the sky. Their eyes glanced level and were fastened upon the waves that swept towards them. These waves were of the hue of slate, save for the tops, which were a foaming white. And all of the men knew the colors of the sea. The horizon narrowed and widened and dipped and rose, and at all times its edge was jagged with waves that seemed thrust up in points like rocks. So that initial metaphorical illusion that none of them knew the color of the sky. They didn't have time to look up at the sky because they were so concentrated on the terrible waves in front of them. And they did know the color of the waves. It was gris oscuro, dark as slate. Many a man ought to have a bathtub larger than the boat which here rode upon the sea. These waves were most wrongfully and barbarously abrupt and tall, and each froth top was a problem in small boat navigation. The cook squatted in the bottom and looked with both eyes at the 6 inches of gunwale which separated him from the ocean. His sleeves were rolled over his fat forearms, and the two flaps of his unbuttoned vest dangled as he bent to bail out the boat. Often he said, "God, that was a narrow clip," as he remarked if he invariably gazed eastward over the broken sea. The oiler steering with one of the two oars in the boats sometimes raised himself suddenly to keep clear of water that swirled in over the storm. It was a thin little oar, and it seemed often ready to snap. The correspondent, pulling at the other oar, watched the waves and wondered why he was there. You can see he's introducing himself as a correspondent that really doesn't know what he's doing in the middle of the sea about to die drowned. The injured captain, lying in the bow, was at this time buried in that profound dejection and indifference which comes temporarily, at least, to even the bravest and most enduring when, willy-nilly, the firm fails, the army loses, and the ship goes down. The mind of the master of a vessel is rooted deep in the timbers of her. Though he command for a day or a decade, and this captain had on him the stern impression of a scene in the grays of dawn, of seven turned faces. If you think about it, can be a metaphorical allusion to dead people. Okay. And later, a stump of a topmast with a white ball on it that slashed to and fro at the waves, went low and lower and down. Thereafter, there was something strange in his voice. Although steady, it was deep with mourning and of a quality beyond oration or tears. "Keep her a little more south, Billy," said he. "A little more south, sir," said the oiler in the stern. A seat in this boat was not unlike a seat upon a bucking bronco, and by the same token, a bronco is not much smaller. The craft pranced and reared and plunged like an animal. As each wave came and she rose for it, she seemed like a horse making at a fence outrageously high. The manner of her scramble over these walls of water is a mystic thing, and moreover, at the top of them, where ordinarily these problems in white water, the foam racing down from the summit of each wave, requiring a new leap and a leap from the air. Then after scornfully bumping a crest, she would slide and race and splash down a long incline and arrive bobbing and nodding in front of the next menace. So if you've ever seen a sea storm and how fishing boats behave in those situations where they reach a huge inclination, and when the wave falls, the boat just plunges into the next wave and hits very hard on the wave and then goes sliding and has to go over that same excruciating process. Imagine that on a rowboat that is not prepared for sea navigation. It's just prepared for emergency situations. They were like this for 30 straight hours. I think that gives you the measure of the exhaustion that they had to endure in this situation. in, let me see where I'm, because I'm reading from a different page. A singular disadvantage of the sea lies in the fact that after successfully surmounting one wave, you discover that there is another behind it just as important and just as nervously anxious to do something effective in the way of swamping boats. In a 10-foot dinghy, one can get an idea of the resources of the sea in the lines of waves. A 10-footer is like 3 meters, more or less. Yeah, I would say it's 3 meters. 3 meters and a half, maybe. Okay, so not very long. Four people on a boat, it's a very uncomfortable and narrow situation. One can get an idea of the resources of the sea in the line of waves that is not probably to the average experience, which is never at sea in a dinghy. As each slaty wall of water approached, it shut all else from the view of the men in the boat. And it was not difficult to imagine that this particular wave was the final outburst of the ocean, the last effort of the grim water. There was a terrible grace in the move of the waves, and they came in silence, save for the snarling of the crests. In the wan light, the faces of the men must have been gray. Their eyes must have glinted in strange ways as they gazed steadily astern. Viewed from a balcony, the whole thing would doubtlessly have been weirdly picturesque. But the men in the boat had no time to see it. And if they had had leisure, there were other things to occupy their mind. The sun swung steadily up the sky, and they knew it was broad day because the color of the sea changed from slate to emerald green, streaked with amber lights, and the foam was like tumbling snow. The process of the breaking day was unknown to them. They were aware only of this effect upon the color of the waves that rolled towards them. As you can see, they're transitioning from night to day. They've been rowing all night, and they still have a very long way to go. In disjointed sentences, the cook and the correspondent argued as to the difference between a life-saving station and a house of refuge. The cook had said, "There's a house of refuge just north of the Mosquito Inlet Light, and as soon as they see us, they'll come off in their boat and pick us up." "As soon as who sees us?" said the correspondent. "The crew," said the cook. "Houses of refuge don't have crews," said the correspondent. "As I understand them, they are only places where clothes and grub are stored for the benefit of shipwrecked people. They don't carry crews. Similar to an alpine hotel, and one of these structures that are very typical in Spanish mountains. So they're not manned. Therefore, if there's an alarm, they're not going to help you because there's normally not going to be anybody there." "Oh, yes, they do," said the cook. "No, they don't," said the correspondent. "Well, we're not there yet anyhow," said the oiler in the stern. "Well," said the cook, "perhaps it's not a house of refuge that I'm thinking of as being near Mosquito Inlet Light. Perhaps it's a life-saving station." "We're not there yet," said the oiler in the stern. When the correspondent again opened his eyes, the sea and the sky were each of the gray hue of the dawning. Later, carmine and gold was painted upon the waters. The morning appeared finally in its splendor, with the sky pure blue and the sunlight flamed on the tips of the waves. On the distant dunes were set many little black cottages, and a tall windmill reared above them. No man, nor dog, nor bicycle appeared on the beach. The cottages might have formed a deserted village. The voyagers scanned the shore. Conference was held in the boat. "Well," said the captain, "if no help is coming, we might better try a run through the surf right away. If we stay out here much longer, we will be too weak to do anything for ourselves at all." They have the dilemma that they know that in open sea, they have very bad conditions, but when they reach the platform, they're going to be met with a wall that is going to push them out. No matter how strong they try to move towards the beach, there's going to be the inertia to push them out again. So they have to fight against that surf. That's what's called the surf when the waves break against the beach and try to reach the beach before they run out of energy and they're not able to swim to the ocean. So they're trying to get as close as possible to be able to swim a distance that they can survive. So that's the dilemma that they have. They can see houses, but they don't see any people, so they have to risk it. The others silently acquiesced in this reason. The boat was headed for the beach. The correspondent wondered if none ever ascended the tall wooden tower, and if then they never looked seaward. This tower was a giant, standing with its back to the plight of the ants. It represented in a degree to the correspondent the serenity of nature amid the struggles of the individual, nature in the wind and nature in the vision of men. She did not seem cruel to him then, nor beneficent, nor treacherous, nor wise, but she was indifferent, flatly indifferent. It is perhaps plausible that a man in this situation, impressed with the unconcern of the universe, should see the innumerable flaws of his life and have them taste wickedly in his mind and wish for another chance. A distinction between right and wrong seems absurdly clear to him. Then, in this new ignorance of the grave edge, and he understands that if he were given another opportunity, he would mend his conduct and his words and be better and brighter during an introduction or at a tea. "Now, boys," said the captain, "she is going to swamp, sure." That means that the boat is going to sink. "All we can do is to work her in as far as possible. And then when she swamps, pile out and scramble for the beach. Keep cool now and don't jump until she swamps, sure." The oiler took the oars. Over his shoulders, he scanned the surf. "Captain," he said, "I think I'd better bring her about and keep her head on to the seas and back her in." "All right, Billy," said the captain. "Back her in." The oiler swung the boat then and seated in the stern. The cook and the correspondent were obliged to look over their shoulders to contemplate the lonely and indifferent shore. The monstrous inshore rollers heaved the boat high until the men were again enabled to see the white sheets of water scudding up the slanted beach. "We won't get in very close," said the captain. Each time a man could wrest his attention from the rollers, he turned his glance towards the shore, and in the expression of the eyes during this contemplation there was a singular quality. The correspondent, observing the others, knew that they were not afraid, but the full meaning of their glances was shrouded. As for himself, he was too tired to grapple fundamentally with the fact. He tried to coerce his mind into thinking of it, but the mind was dominated at this time by the muscles, and the muscles said they did not care. It immediately occurred to him that if he should drown, it would be a shame. There were no hurried words, no parlor, no plain agitation. The men simply looked at the shore. "Now remember to get well clear of the boat when you jump," said the captain. Seaward, the crest of the roller suddenly fell with a thunderous crash, and the long white comber came roaring down upon the boat. "Steady now," said the captain. The men were silent. They turned their eyes from the shore to the comber and waited. The boat slid up the incline, leaped at the furious top, bounced over it, and swung back down the long back of the wave. Some water had been shipped, and the cook bailed it out. But the next crest crashed also, a tumbling, boiling flood of white water all sides. White water caught the boat and whirled it almost perpendicular. Water swarmed in from all sides. My God, I'm reading terrible today. The correspondent had his hands on the gunwale at this time, and when the water entered at the place, he swiftly withdrew his fingers as he objected to wetting them. The little boats, drunken with this weight of water, reeled and snuggled deeper into the sea. "Bail her out, cook, bail her out," said the captain. "All right, captain," said the cook. "Now, boys, the next one will do us for sure. Will do for us
sure, said the oiler. Mind to jump clear of the boat. Okay, this is a great moment where they have to jump and hit for the beach. The third wave moved forward, huge, furious, implacable. It barely swallowed the dinghy, and almost simultaneously the men tumbled into the sea. A piece of life belt had lain in the bottom of the boat, and as a correspondent went overboard, he held this to his chest with his left hand. The January water was icy, and he reflected immediately that it was colder than he had expected to find it off the coast of Florida. This appeared to his dazed mind as a fact important enough to be noted at the time. The coldness of the water was sad. It was tragic. This fact was somehow so mixed and confused with his opinion of his own situation that it seemed almost a proper reason for tears. The water was cold. When he came to the surface, he was conscious of little but the noisy water. Afterwards, he saw his companions in the sea. The oiler was ahead in the race. He was swimming strongly and rapidly. Off to the correspondent's left, the cook, great, white, and corked, back bulged out of the water. And in the rear, the captain was hanging with his good hand to the keel of the overturned dinghy. There is a certain immovable quality to the shore, and the correspondent wondered at it amid the confusion of the sea. It seemed also very attractive, but the correspondent knew that it was a long journey, and he paddled leisurely. The piece of life preserver lay under him, and sometimes he whirled down the incline of a wave as if he were on a handsled. But finally he arrived at a place in the sea where travel was beset with difficulty. He did not pause swimming to inquire what manner of current had caught him, but there his progress ceased. The shore was set before him like a bit of scenery on a stage, and he looked at it and understood with his eyes each detail of it. As a cook passed much farther to his left, the captain was calling to him, "Turn over on your back, cook. Turn over on your back and use the oar." "All right, sir." The cook turned on his back and paddling with the oar, went ahead as if he were a canoe. Presently, the boat also passed to the left of the correspondent, with the captain clinging with one hand to the keel. He would have appeared like a man raising himself to look over a board fence, if it were not for the extraordinary gymnastics of the boat. The correspondent marveled that the captain could still hold to it. They passed on, nearer to shore. The oiler, the cook, the captain, and the following them went the water jar, bouncing gaily over the seas. The correspondent remained in the grip of this strange new enemy, a current. The shore, with its white slope of sand and its green bluff, topped with little silent cottages, was spread like a picture before him. It was very near to him then, but he was impressed as one who in gallery looks at a scene from Brittany or Holland. So there you see the impressionistic view, the impression that it causes in him. He thought, "I am going to drown. Can it be possible? Can it be possible? Can it be possible? Perhaps an individual must consider his own death to be the final phenomenon of nature." But later a wave perhaps whirled him out of his small deadly current, for he found suddenly that he could again make progress towards the shore. Later still, he was aware that the captain, clinging with one hand to the keel of the dinghy, had his face turned away from the shore and towards him, and he was calling his name. "Come to the boat! Come to the boat!" In his struggle to reach the captain and the boat, he reflected that when one gets properly wearied, drowning must really be a comfortable arrangement, a cessation of hostilities accompanied by a large degree of relief, and he was glad of it, for the main thing in his mind for some moments had been horror of the temporary agony. He did not wish to be hurt. Presently he saw a man running along the shore. He was undressing with most remarkable speed. Coat, trousers, shirt, everything flew magically off him. "Come to the boat," called the captain. "All right, captain," as the correspondent paddled to saw the captain let himself down to bottom and leave the boat. Then the correspondent performed his one little marvel of the voyage. A large wave caught him and flung him with ease and supreme speed completely over the boat and far beyond it. It struck him even then as an event in gymnastics and a true miracle of the sea. An overturned boat in the surf is not a plaything to a swimming man. The correspondent arrived in water that reached only to the waist, but his condition did not enable him to stand for more than a moment. Each wave knocked him into a heap, and the undertow pulled at him. Then he saw a man who had been running, the man who had been running and undressing, and undressing and running, come bounding into the water. He dragged ashore the cook and then waded towards the captain. But the captain waved him away and sent him to the correspondent. He was naked, naked as a tree in winter, but the halo was about his head, and he shone like an angel. He gave a strong pull and a long drag and a bully heave at the correspondent's hand. The correspondent, schooled in the minor formulae, said, "Thanks, old man." But suddenly the man cried, "What's that?" He pointed a swift finger. The correspondent said, "Go." In the shallows, face downward, lay the oiler. His forehead touched sand that was periodically between each wave clear of the sea. The correspondent did not know all that transpired afterwards. When he achieved safe ground, he fell, striking the sand with each particular part of his body. It was as if he had dropped from a roof, but the thud was grateful to him. It seems that instantly the beach was populated with men with blankets, clothes, and flasks, and women with coffee pots and all the remedies sacred to their mind. The welcome of the land to the men from the seas was warm and generous, but a still and dripping shape was carried slowly up the beach, and the land's welcome for it could only be the indifferent and sinister hospitality of the grave. When it came night, the white waves paced to and fro in the moonlight, and the wind brought the sound of the great sea's voice to the men on shore, and that they felt and that they could then be interpreters. As you can see, there is a, there are like strokes of a personal point of view, sometimes belief, sometimes relief, in the middle of something that is very harsh and very dramatic, and normally centered on the water more than on the people. The people are like damage that happens because they get in the way of the sea. Well, this is the author that closes our set list for the course. Do you have any questions that you want to address? We have a couple of minutes before the exam. Is there any author in particular that you find challenging, that you don't know how to face? Well, because I mean, it's the same way that sometimes the sea gets that name. There could be a tint of sexism in that conversation. I really wouldn't know if it's because he considers the boat and the sea to have their own will, and therefore to be free and like a woman. But yeah, it's an interesting reflection. I can't give you an explanation. Any other questions? It's an interesting topic. I'm going to try to find an explanation of why Stephen Crane talks about boats as a she. Which authors do you find more difficult to study? Emily Dickinson. Okay. I think that some of you still don't have your corrections to the PEC. I have them overdue. I have so many subjects. They all simultaneously put the same date of the corrections, so I just don't cope. I have the same problem every year. I'll get them hopefully by this weekend, hopefully, crossing my fingers. And thank you very much for your patience. Remember that you can still contact me by email, ask me any doubts you might have, best luck in the examination. I'm really rooting for you guys. I hope you're very successful. And thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be here. It's been a fantastic collection of, I think it's been 23 or 24 weeks. And thanks a lot, especially to those of you that have very rarely failed, if any time. So thanks a lot. Okay.